Okay, today's lecture is entitled Fundamentals of Healthcare-Associated Infection Definitions. Paul had asked me to do this lecture a while ago, and his feeling was that it was something interesting to review with particularly those people who are starting in infection control in different countries, particularly where we may not have standard definitions or standard methodology to be used to identify what we call healthcare-associated infections. So you have there on the first slide the disclosure statement from myself. And on the next slide is our learning objectives for today. Number one, explain why applying uniform definitions are necessary. Number two will be describe a well-accepted central line associated bacteremia CLAB definition and provide case scenarios. And thirdly, describe a well-accepted ventilator-associated pneumonia VAP definition and provide case scenarios for that as well. Now, I do not have a slide for the fourth one, provide formulas that determine rates of infection. However, if somebody does remind me, I will be very happy to verbalize those for you, and they're not very complex, so we can spend a few minutes on that as well. Okay, the next slide is the pressures to determine accurate rates. In the United States in particular, there has been now over the last several years enormous pressures from many different variables to help define what our definitions are for HAIs and in order to produce accurate rates. And I'll go through some of them in particular, and I'm sure that much of this also applies to other countries, since now over the last several years there has been much written and lectured about in regard to preventing these HAIs, which has very high mortality rates among those patients who receive either central lines or on ventilators. One of the prime issues is to reduce mortality. The Institute for Healthcare the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, which is an organization in the United States that started several years ago, was really in response to a report that had said that about 100,000 Americans died each year from medical errors. Their impetus then was essentially to create an organization like IHI, which now really coordinates and has convinced many of the hospitals to implement preventive programs to reduce both CLAB and VAP rates. Currently, there are more than 3,200 U.S. hospitals that are participating. Essentially, this really requires the hospitals to implement bundles, that is, components that have been known scientifically to support the elimination of those kinds of infections. Much of this is carried out in the organizations through the efforts of the leadership in the organization, but is directly implemented by teams that have been formed. And these teams usually then are concentrated in the adult critical care units, but certainly there now has, in the last year or more, been greater efforts, for example, into pediatric and neonatal ICUs to reduce those kinds of events as well through this same kind of system. On the next slide is the issue of the local report card, that is mandatory reporting. In the United States now, there are at least 40 states of the 50 that have legislation, statewide legislation, that will require infection control programs to report certain types of infections that are identified in the individual hospitals. And they may be including things such as central line associated bacteremias or VAP as well. This is laws that have been passed over the last several years, and there are other states that are pending with this kind of legislation. These events really occurred because of a lot of the community involvement and community concern about these kinds of infections that have been occurring over the last decades in hospitals, and became certainly a political issue with political pressures for hospitals now to perform better, in other words, to improve their patient safety records. But essentially what this has now become is really a report card, because when you do report this through systems, which I'll describe in a minute, you will now be compared to other hospitals throughout your individual state. So here, for example, at the State University of New York at Stony Brook, we do report any number of infections that are required by the state of New York, and this goes into the national database under NHSN, and New York State has an agreement with them to pull data out of their network and produce reports which will compare one hospital to another for their CLAB rates, et cetera. So the enormous pressures of community concerns is now a very big issue here. Let's see now. On the next slide is the pressures from CMS. CMS is the national organization in the United States which controls the payments for things like Medicaid and Medicare, which are some of the basic funding for healthcare here in this country. There are literally tens of millions of people in the United States that are covered under Medicaid and Medicare. And several years ago, this branch of the government decided that they were going to begin to essentially regulate the amount of money that was going to be paid for certain events that would occur. And for example, things such as catheter-associated BSI will no longer be paid fully by CMS for two hospitals that have reported that these patients then have catheters inserted. This can then certainly parlay into a significant amount of money for hospitals, and I don't think I have to explain to anybody now the world economy picture right now and the pressures on each individual state to reduce their costs associated with Medicaid and Medicare. So this becomes a very, very important issue. And you see here on the list many of the different kinds of conditions where CMS will no longer pay. And this occurred, for example, starting to track in 2007, and this is now an issue because payments stopped in October of last year. Continuing with the thought about reimbursement, there have now been any number of articles that have been published about the issues of further reduction in payments for any of the additional kinds of infections that are that occur as hospital-acquired, urinary tract infections, surgical site infections, etc., all are really money issues and things that which will be impacting severely for hospitals since they, for some there are any number of significant quantities of cases that occur among these institutions. So there is then the enormous pressure of prevention. However, this lecture is not about prevention. This lecture is to try to identify accurately the infections that do occur, but also very important is the other side of the coin, in which we'll talk about, is to try to make, to identify infections as closely to a set standard of definition so that we don't over-report and therefore reduce the amount of payment as well that we may receive. On the next slide is the most important article in regard to healthcare-associated infections. This was published in the American Journal of Infection Control and is a fairly recent article, and it summarizes the definitions as published by the Centers for Disease Control. These are definitions that have been reviewed by experts throughout the United States and have been really an evolution because these there have been different versions, and the one you see here is the latest and greatest. I'll be going back to using, you know, in during the lecture, definitions from this particular article, and it is fairly comprehensive because it not only covers such things as laboratory confirmed bloodstream infections, but also pneumonias and gastrointestinal infections and skin infections, et cetera, all types of infections that can be seen and can be certainly occur as hospital acquired infections. On the next slide, you see the computer face, the website for the CDC's NHSN system in which hospitals that are enrolled in the United States input the events. So that's what they're called. When you have, for example, a CLAB infection occur, we enter this, and I say we, that would mean into, you know, through the infection control departments that have acquired a digital certificate, and this is a fairly complex system here in order to maintain, you know, confidentiality, et cetera, et cetera. The department director applies for this certificate and goes through a whole litany of approvals, et cetera. And once that is approved, they can add other people within their department who will then be inputting the information for each event. So just very briefly right here on this interface, you can see that each facility would have a facility ID number, and you enter the information, for example, and the patient ID is a medical record number, et cetera, and the patient information. And as you do that, then you're eventually going to input the event type, which would be a, for example, a laboratory confirmed BSI, and eventually identify that as a central line infection, and we'll talk a little bit about the criteria later. But all those portions of the criteria are included in this NHSN system. So this is one of the reasons why we have to understand how to use that definition very, very well. Okay, so let's go through the definitions that apply to bloodstream infections. In this document, we come across the following. And it defines what a laboratory-confirmed BSI, bloodstream infection, is. And we have to then apply this, obviously, to patients that have central lines. So a patient, let's say, that is in an ICU, whether they're an adult or a child, then you will apply the definition that you see here to that patient. We'll go a little bit more specific into the central line issue, et cetera, in a few minutes. But it says here that an LCBI must meet one of the following three criteria. Criterion 1 and 2 may be used for patients of any age, including patients less than 1 year of age. So if you are doing, for example, surveillance, infection control surveillance for adults, the first two criteria apply. So that when you are then identifying patients in an ICU that have central lines, and you've been putting this, let's say, on a worksheet, et cetera, and then you're going to be looking up blood cultures, et cetera, this is what you want to be able to do, is to apply the following two criteria to see whether you determined that this is a central line associated bacteremia. The first one says, patient has a recognized pathogen from one or more blood cultures, and the organism cultured from blood is not related to an infection at another site. We'll define what these recognized pathogens are in a second. But what we take from this definition is very important, is that there are really two parts to it, that we identify a pathogen from either one or more blood cultures, and that the organism cultured, that we did not identify that organism as being the cause of an infection at another site. So we'll talk a little bit about doing rounds in a little while, and about how you can focus in to try to determine whether this is not a central line infection. Number two, patient has at least one of the following signs or symptoms: fever, chills, or hypertension, and signs and symptoms and positive laboratory results are not related to an infection on the site. And in addition to that, it says, and common skin contaminant. So in other words, something either like a diphtheroid or bacillus, or a coagulase negative staph, including staph epidermidis, a strep viridans, is cultured from two or more blood cultures drawn on separate occasions. And we'll define here what separate occasions means under the definition as well. So if you have, for example, a gram-positive organism that is growing out in a blood culture on a patient who has a central line, let's say at day 5 or day 6 after insertion, you will then be considering that it's possible that it could fit now into criteria 2. However, it could be criteria 1 if it's, for example, like an enterococcus, a faecalis or a faecium. But here then, if it finally is identified, it's a staph epi, then you know then you're going to need not one blood culture for definitive determination, but you're going to need two. Criterion 3 is for patients less than 1 year of age. and has at least one of the following signs and symptoms. Again, fever, taken rectally, hypothermia, again, rectal temperature, apnea, or bradycardia. And again, the signs and symptoms and positive laboratory results are not related to an infection at another site. And it goes again into the same portion of the definition under criteria 2. If it's a skin contaminant, and then it goes on to say, and it's cultured from two or more blood cultures drawn on separate occasions. Okay, let's take a look at some of the notes that they have in the definition, because these are very critical to understand. In criterion 1, the phrase one or more blood cultures means that at least one bottle from a blood draw is reported by the laboratory as having grown organisms, that is, a positive blood culture. And it says here, note, a blood culture set is usually is comprised of one aerobic and one anaerobic blood culture bottle. So in other words, in the real world, if I'm looking at blood cultures that are growing, usually you'll have a set that's taken. That is actually two blood culture bottles, but one looking for anaerobic organisms, the other one for aerobic. That's considered to be one single blood culture. So if I have a staph epi growing from one, then the next set that is taken is counted as second, not the second bottle. In criterion one, the term recognized pathogen does not include organisms considered common skin contaminants. It says a few of the recognized pathogens are staph aureus, enterococcus species, E. coli, Pseudomonas, Klebsiella candida. And don't forget to add such things as Serratia species and Acinetobacter, which has become very prominent in hospitals as causing infections, and also one of the prime multi-drug resistant organisms. Here is the first tip of the day here for surveillance. When you are conducting surveillance rounds, especially if performed with a team, like say you're doing as part of the IHI rounds, review the initial results on all blood cultures as reported by the microbiology lab and take immediate investigative action before the organism is definitively identified. So in other words, why is this important? Because if you have a patient, for example, that's in a medical ICU, one of the things you should try to find out is what other invasive devices do they have and what other possible sources can this organism be coming from. They could have, for example, things like an intra-abdominal abscess or an abscess in some other location. They can have a pneumonia. They can have a urinary tract infection. They can have any number of other things in which you may have to take action to get other cultures from those sites so that they will fit into other definitions in which, therefore, now you can eliminate this case as being CLAB if it's positive for the same organism and it fits the rest of the criteria in the definition. We'll go through those a little bit later. Also, example, patient has a central line of MICU and after 5 days of positive, I basically kind of said that, right, didn't I? Okay, let's go on. Surveillance tip 2. When a blood culture is initially reported as growing gram-positive cocci, it will most likely mean that a patient is growing staph aureus, perhaps MRSA, a pathogen under criterion 1, or patient is growing streptococcus, which could be group D enterococcus, perhaps VRE, again, if it's going to be an enterococcus, it would automatically fit into criteria 1 unless I could prove it that it's another site. Patient is growing another staphylococcus species, example, staph epi, in which case criteria 2 would have to be met in order for the event to be a CLAB. And here what I did was I made a couple of tables for all of you. And I think these are very helpful relatively also for the new practitioners in the audience. When you're going to be doing these rounds and you see the lab reporting gram-positive cocci, okay, we're automatically going to know that in general it's going to fit into the categories that you see here. And you have a list here of what infections they're generally associated with and some lab notes, like I mentioned before. If a staph aureus, it could turn out to be MRSA as well. And generally, staph aureus through the lab is reported out as coagulase positive, okay? And I mention that because it's very important because the lab may report out initially that the blood culture is positive, it's growing out of gram-positive cocci, and it's coagulase negative, and therefore now you have the first evidence, hint, to say that, oh, this is not Staph aureus, it could be Staph epi or something else. Okay. And on the next page you have a further list of some of those. And you see, for example, these are the streptococcus, again, gram-positives as well. And gram-positives generally will be broken out into different categories and different groups. So the lab may report it out as a group, group A strep, group B strep, group C strep. And the D is very important because as soon as you see that it's possibly it's a group D, it's going to be enterococcus. And automatically it's going to fit into the possibility that it's in criteria 1. Okay. Consider the following. If blood culture positive for Staph aureus, order additional cultures from other sites. If blood culture is positive for enterococcus, same thing. Don't wait for the final species. If blood culture positive for Staph epi, remember that other parts of criteria 2 must be met for the case to be a CLAB. Okay, now we go on to some more notes. If criteria 2 and 3, in criteria 2 and 3, the phrase two or more blood cultures drawn on separate occasions means, one, that the blood drawn from at least two blood draws were collected within 2 days of each other. In other words, bloods drawn Monday and Wednesday, as an example, that is good. Well, I guess not good because if it is a CLAB, it's a CLAB. But you follow my thought process here. If it's drawn on Mondays and a Thursday, then it's beyond the 48 hours, and it would not meet criteria 3. And number two, that at least one bottle from each blood draw is reported by laboratories having grown the same common skin contaminant organism. For pediatric draw, it may consist of a single bottle due to volume constraints. Okay? And they also have notes regarding the sameness of the organism. If one blood draw is reported as Staph epi, and then 48 hours later, a second blood draw was drawn, and it reported out as coagulase negative Staph, then it's considered to be the same, and it's reported essentially as Staph epidermidis. And if you can't find this as an infection in another site, this would be a CLAB criteria 2. And the next slide basically shows you as more as an algorithm kind of thing for criteria 1 and 2. Let's go on to scenario number 1. In scenario number 1, we have a 54-year-old male who's a diabetic, comes in as AFib as well. He's an obese patient. He complains of chest pain. Now, on day 0, he's admitted to the ER. He has a right femoral central line inserted. And on day 1, he's admitted into medical ICU. He has a right femoral removal. Actually, this is not actually perfectly correct. Day 0 is always the day that the patient comes into medical ICU or one of your other ICUs. If the patient, for example, has a line inserted at any other place, whether it's the OR, the ER, or even if it's inherited, whatever day they come into your ICU, that is day 0, and then after that it's 1, 2, 3, etc. Okay, so back to actually day 0 is admit to medical ICU. You have a right femoral removed and a left IJ is placed. On day 5, the patient spikes a temperature of 101.8, blood culture is coag negative Staph, and a catheter tip from that original catheter shows a coag negative Staph as well, and his WBC now is 13.1. Is this a CLAB according to the definition? Now, the answer to this is no. Why? Because a coag negative Staph is considered to be a contaminant, and you need to have more than one blood culture. You need to have two drawn within 48 hours. And in this case, it was not. Scenario 2, a 72-year-old male, motor vehicle accident, broken ribs, leg injury, abdominal trauma. On day 0, he comes into the emergency room, transferred to the OR, right subclavian inserted, abdominal surgery to repair the liver laceration. He is admitted into the surgical ICU. We'll consider that then on day 1, he has a urinary catheter, he has a chest tube, etc. And now on day 8, he has a temperature of 102.2, a WBC of 14.3. He has a right subclavian changed over a guide wire. He has abdominal pain. A CT scan shows abdominal abscess. And on day 10, he has a blood culture reported as gram-positive cocci and chains. And the final report is that he has Enterococcus faecalis, group D. Is this a collab? Well, let's go on to the next slide. Here is where you have to be really kind of these CSI detective kind of things. Because what you're, in this case, trying to do is to try to find out whether this patient has, we can take CDC's definition and say, well, does this patient have a way to say that he has an infection at another site and therefore doesn't really have CLEB? And this is their definition, which is in the guideline I showed you before, for gastrointestinal tract infections, which includes esophagus, stomach, small and large bowel, and rectum, excluding gastroenteritis and appendicitis. Patient has an abscess or other evidence of infection seen during surgical operation or histopathologic examination. Patient has at least two of the following signs or symptoms with no other recognized cause and compatible with infection of the organ or tissue involved. So the patient has to have fever, nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, or tenderness, and at least one of the following: organisms cultured from drainage or tissue obtained during a surgical operation or endoscopy or from a surgically placed drain. Organisms seen on a Gram stain or KOH stain or multinucleated giant cell stain or on microscopic examination of drainage or tissue obtained during a surgical operation or endoscopy or a surgically placed drain. Or organisms cultured from the blood. Evidence of pathologic findings on radiographic examination or evidence of pathologic findings on endoscopic examination. If we go back here, this patient exhibited what? Two things which may now eliminate this as a CLEB infection. Number one, the patient has abdominal pain. And number two, he has a CAT scan that shows an abdominal abscess. And he has a positive blood culture then. So according to the definition under number two, he has abdominal pain and at least one of the following, and therefore that is not a CLEB infection. Scenario number three, 66-year-old female, diabetic, cellulitis, GI bleeder, comes into the ER. A peripheral IV is inserted. On day one, is admitted to a medical unit. A PIC is placed. By day five, patient, they have hypertension, respiratory failure, they're intubated, they're transferred to the MICU, and on day six, the patient has temperature 99.5, WC of 12.1, a blood culture E. coli, which is ESBL positive. The line is removed, the cath tip shows staph epi, and on day seven, a urine culture is showing E. coli ESBL positive with 10 to the fifth CFU. Is this a CLEB? Well, here's the definition for urinary tract infection definition. If you look at the symptoms that the patient had and what was reported by the laboratory, the person has what? They both have an E. coli ESBL positive, and at this point I'm assuming that the sensitivity is the same. It's very important to look at that as well. And it fits into the criteria of number two, which is that the patient has a fever, okay? Difficult, though, to tell the rest of it in a patient who's in ICU. However, it does fit into the definition that they have a urine culture which shows greater than 10 to the 5th microorganisms. And I didn't, by the way, put that as a correct designation, but it is greater than 10 to the 5th microorganisms per cc of urine with no more than 2 microorganisms. So again, this patient has a documented urinary tract infection according to definition, and therefore it is not a CLEB infection. 49-year-old female, cervical CA, Hickman catheter inserted 3 months prior to hospitalization. Pain and weakness. On day zero, patient is admitted to the ER, admitted to a medical unit. On day six, person has respiratory failure. They're intubated. They're transferred to a medical ICU. And on day seven, they have a temperature of 100, blood pressure 100 over 55, a blood culture coag-negative staph. And a coag-negative staph is growing from one of two bottles in the same drawer. On day 8, the blood culture is negative. Day 9, temperature 100.8, WC 12.7, and a blood culture, again, staph epi, showing one of two blood cultures. And on day 11 is blood culture staph hemolyticus, and day 11 is blood culture staph hemolyticus as well. Is this a CLEB? Well, there's a distinct possibility not knowing anything else at this point, because number one, we have a gram-positive cocci, which is considered to be a contaminant, that is the coag-negative staph, growing on day 7, and within 48 hours has a second blood culture that comes up positive, so fits criteria 2. Now, on day 11, this person has a 2 additional blood cultures that come up positive. And someone may ask, is this now a second CLAB event? Well, unless I have more information in regard to whether this is an infection in another site or whether you consider this to be a pathogen, this person has definitively 1 CLAB at this point with the staph epi. And scenario number 5, 32-year-old male, ruptured appendix, day 0, admitted to the ER, OR abdominal surgery, admitted to the surgical ICU. Day 5 is a temperature 99.4. Day 6, his temperature goes up. His blood pressure is 105 over 62. A blood culture is now growing out, showing Klebsiella pneumoniae. On day 7, he has a temperature of 100.3. WBC is 10 now. And on day 8, he has a chest x-ray with no infiltrates, consolidation, or congestion. And he has a sputum culture showing Kleb pneumoniae. Is this a Kleb? Well, what has to be really considered here then is this person having an infection at another site? And if there is no definitive identification as of this pneumonia under definition, this would be a CLAB, given that we have no definite identification of an infection at another site. And it would, at this point, with the information on day 8, it would not be very supportive, even without looking at the definition, that this person does not have pneumonia because his chest x-ray is negative and has no consolidation or even congestion. And I put in the next slide a couple of things about pneumonia definitions. getting now into the whole issue of VAP. Over the last couple of years, there has been a number of very good articles now published about trying to redefine really what pneumonia is and breaking out into further categories that we had before. We had such things as hospital-acquired pneumonia now, HAP, and of course VAP, and HCAP, which is healthcare-associated pneumonia, and they certainly have their differences among them, and I would suggest that you use the article that you see here, which was published in 2006, and there's a number of other very good articles published about this issue as well. But we're going to try to concentrate somewhat here about the issue of ventilator-associated pneumonia and applying the pneumonia definitions to whether we have that occurring. I will tell you, though, that in my experience, pneumonia is, if not the hardest infection to identify. And if we look in the literature, this has certainly, I think, been very well supported, even among some of the very, very well-published physicians who have done a lot of research in this area. Even from hospital, it's very difficult to get people to agree definitively on cases of pneumonia. However, the definition does exist, and in the respect of mandatory hospital reporting now, we have to try to get, you know, and use this standard definition to try to narrow down these kinds of cases. So definitions applying to VAP. Now, you have here an algorithm which looks on the surface fairly complex, and this is, again, contained in the CDC definitions that I had shown you before. I'm going to try to concentrate a little bit more on what we call pneumonia type 1. And pneumonia type 1 applies to patients that have underlying diseases. And if you can see, there really is essentially 3 different sets of criteria that you have to confirm before you can identify someone as having pneumonia 1. And obviously, if they're on a ventilator, then it's more than likely that this is a ventilator-associated pneumonia if they meet all of those criteria. On the next slide, I made it a little bit easier for you to read. And this is, again, the NHSN system that is reported as part of CDC that we report out into the system and eventually determine someone possibly is having pneumonia type 1. And under the first criteria in that algorithm, it says that if you have in a patient 2 or more serial x-rays with one of the following: a new or progressive and persistent infiltrate, consolidation, a cavitation or pneumocele in someone less than 1 year of age. More often than not, what you're going to see in someone who has the possibility of having pneumonia is the first two bullet points, which is either developing a new progressive infiltrate or they will report it out as consolidation. On the number two, it says at least one of the following: that they have fever with no other cause, either they have leukopenia or leukocytosis, or altered mental status. Now, the last bullet point there, altered mental status, is very difficult to determine and sometimes can be fairly objective, especially in someone who is, you know, on a ventilator and is being sedated. Obviously, we're not going to be able to tell in those things. So we have to really use the other criteria that's there. And it's obviously very, very readily available, you know, through the computer systems and through the medical record, the information in the medical record, et cetera. And then the third part of the question says at least one of the following. It's either new onset of purulent sputum or change in character of sputum or an increase in respiratory secretions or increase in suctioning requirements. Now, what's the problem with that one? Well, again, that could be fairly subjective. You can have, for example, a nurse saying, you know, that this person now has purulent sputum. And to another nurse, it may not be exactly to that point, or it might not necessarily be that change in a great character from what they had seen it before on one of their shifts. So this is not something that we can apply numbers to. It is fairly objective from person to person. The second bullet point says new onset or worsening cough, dyspnea, or tachypnea. So therefore, again, these are things that we're going to have to get this information one way or another, whether it's through some, you know, directly from the medical record, or what we do here is we have a monitoring tool in which the nurse puts down all these criteria so that we get something more uniform and it covers all the days that a person is on a ventilator. The next one is rales or bronchial breath sounds or worsening gas exchange. And again, worsening gas exchange, you can get numbers, but again, it then requires you to get all these numbers and get and make a calculation in which the number has to be less than 240 in order to meet this portion of the criteria. Here's some questions that I reproduced from a document that was produced here in New York State, given that there are certain programs here that in which we report ventilator-associated pneumonia. Question number one, if the patient is intubated pre-admission, how should we determine the VAP? Well, if the VAP was if the patient was symptom-free at the time of the intubation by the paramedic or emergency department and meets the CDC NHSN criteria algorithm for VAP, it is a positive device-associated pneumonia. However, if the patient was intubated and received care at another hospital and subsequently transferred to your facility, then you need to apply the 48-hour rule. Only pneumonias appearing 48 hours post-admission would be considered a VAP in those patients who you are receiving that already are on a ventilator. Question two. If a VAP occurs within 48 hours of intubation, is it considered hospital-acquired? Yes, the development of VAP can occur within 48 hours of intubation. And again, this is for the person that you intubate here at a facility, at a hospital setting, not somebody that you inherit with that was intubated at another facility. Question number three, what is the minimum time frame? There is no minimum period of time that a ventilator must be in place in order for the pneumonia to be ventilator associated, except for the transfer in example number two. In other words, what they're trying to do here is take into consideration the possibility that somebody aspirated at the time of intubation, you know, in your facility, like say even in your emergency room, and that the pneumonia developed fairly quickly after that. Number four, do we call it a VAP if the patient aspirated on intubation? If the patient was symptom-free and had obvious aspiration at the time of intubation, it is a hospital-associated event. If the patient met the VAP criteria, the answer is yes. And in number five, what is the definition of a VAP? Well, again, not to belay the point, but it is a pneumonia that occurs in a patient who was intubated and ventilated at the time of or within 48 hours before the onset of pneumonia. Number six says, I rarely have a VAP defined as pneumonia 2 or pneumonia 3. What am I doing wrong? If you'll notice, then the algorithms, you also have pneumonias 2 and 3 as definitions. Generally, you're not doing anything wrong. In general, the majority of VAPs identified through surveillance fall into pneumonia 1. This is because most VAP are clinically diagnosed without specific lab findings to confirm the exact etiology that would place them into a category, into a pneumonia 2 category. So if you look carefully at pneumonia 2, it does differ from pneumonia 1 in the lab findings that you can look up. Number seven, why do we use pneumonia 1, 2, and 3? Pneumonia 1 is a domain where all the clinically defined pneumonias are tracked. Clinically defined meaning the use of chest x-rays along with the patient's signs and symptoms. Pneumonia 2 tracks pneumonias with specific lab confirmation. In other words, they have positive blood or pleural cultures, quantitative cultures, PCR antibodies, etc. And pneumonia 3 tracks pneumonias in immunocompromised patients. It is certainly helpful when we understand that in pneumonia 2, we need accuracy in terms of the specimen collection. It's preferable, obviously, that patients are bronched to be more accurate, but this may not be the case in most of the situations that you have. I'm sorry, I think I duplicated this. Let's just skip that one here. And question 8, regardless, is it correct that the first step is a chest x-ray finding? Correct. You're looking for a new or progressive and persistent infiltrate consolidation, cavitation, or pneumatoceles in a patient less than 1 year of age. The other clarification comes with determining if a patient is with or without underlying disease. If the patient does not have underlying disease, one or more serial x-rays with one of the findings is enough. If the patient does have underlying disease, two or more serial x-rays with findings is necessary. And you have to look at the very fine print in the definition because it goes on to say the following. Note, underlying disease includes patients with pulmonary or cardiac disease, example, interstitial lung disease or congestive heart failure. And also remember, radiologists report things in various different ways at various hospitals. So they may be reporting pneumonia and using different terminology to say airspace disease or focal opacification, or they use the terminology patchy areas of increased density. They love to kind of really fool us, don't they? Okay. Let's get to as many scenarios as we can. I think I have three. And you know what you could do if you have any questions? You can answer the question as to whether these patients actually have VAP. The first is a patient, a 62-year-old male with a history of bypass surgery, COPD, renal failure, is admitted to a medical ICU. On 0-2 intubation days, in other words, prior to intubation, he has the listed criteria there, the signs and symptoms as you see listed there. And the CAT scan reads as follows. As CAT scan done, it says diffuse nodules across both lung fields with ground glass opacities may be due to infectious process. Bronchi appear completely obstructed and may indicate bronchopneumonia. And then on the day zero of intubation, he comes into the unit, he's intubated. The chest x-ray says he's has an endotracheal tube. He has diffuse airspace disease, increased infiltrates in right lung base. On day one, it reads diffuse patchy consolidations and nodules, congestion. Day three, it reads opacities of both lungs, no change. And on day four, he has a CAT scan, which shows marked progression of ground glass opacities, bronchopneumonia, new consolidation, bilateral upper lobes, and less extensive lower lobes, progression of bronchopneumonia versus ARDS. Okay. Our next scenario is a patient comes in with a history of emphysema, recent bypass surgery, diabetic, comes into a cardiac intensive care unit. On day zero, they're intubated. Patient has severe emphysema, no consolidation, effusion, or congestion. On day five, it reads a severe emphysema unchanged. Day 12, no consolidations, congestions, or effusions. On day 15, patient is trached. Still has evidence of pneumonia, lungs are clear. On day 20, patient has a moderate congestion, edema. On day 23, bilateral infiltrates, no change. Day 24, we're looking at WBCs as having dropped. Patient's temperature is going up. It's being reported that his sputum is looking a little bit different in color. And his blood pressure and the patient's blood pressure is now down to 106/73. And they were being reported as bilateral infiltrates, both lower lungs, right upper lung. And again, you could see the ones on day 26 following the same patterns in terms of WBCs being low. Temperature, again, as you see, over 100, with a blood pressure of 111/65. And last but not least, we have our 48-year-old female with a history of high blood pressure, renal disease patient intubated 4 days prior at another facility admitted to a medical ICU. So on day zero is the day that we receive the patient. The patient has an endotracheal tube, and the chest x-ray is reading left lower lobe nodule, no consolidated effusion or congestion. Patient comes in to us with a WBC of 12.8, a temperature over 101, and a blood pressure of 120/22/75, sputum indicating clear. The further days as we go on, the congestion has a right upper lobe density, a right upper lobe and right middle lobe consolidation, lower lobe patchy densities, and unfortunately on day three, this patient expires. So thank you very much, and if you'd like to call in and ask me about the three and give me your opinion as to whether those are VAP or no, according to the definition. Thank you so much.
Oh, I was going to – thank you very much. I was about to ask you if those are VAP or not, but you're just going to leave that hanging, right?
Well, I want to kind of see the audience know, take a good guess as to what they think that these are VAPs or not.
Well, I'm actually going to open the line in just a second and ask people to answer that question. You mentioned at the early part that you would provide formulas that determine
sure.
the rates of infection. Have you got those handy?
I don't have them on the slide, but let me verbalize them.
Yep.
They're fairly straightforward. What's generally accepted and the one that is most accurate is where the denominator is the device days. The numerator then would be the number of identified health HAIs that you have. So in the case of CLABs, it would be the number of CLAB infections you have in a given month divided by the central line days that you have in that same month. And the way that you would add up the denominator would be, just as an example, you have Mr. Jones with a line in for 5 days and Mr. Smith with a line in for 3 days, and et cetera, et cetera. Adding those two patients up, you would have 8 days, and you would add up all the patients and their central line days. And then you multiply that by 1,000, and you would read that as the number of infections per 1,000 central line days. The exact same thing with somebody on a ventilator, except they are now ventes. The numerator is the number of VAP cases. You multiply by 1,000. And you get that formula. That is the accepted rate now for a number of years. And if you look at the NHSN information that's published now on a yearly basis of the national, what they originally called the NNIS system, which certain hospitals reported their system going back now 15-plus years ago, what would happen then is that they list everything by percentages. So in other words, if you looked in that table, and again, I don't have it in front of me, what is a 50th percentile, et cetera, you can gauge your hospital and do a comparison roughly based on your rate, per 1,000 device days, compared to a United States national rate of a couple of hundred hospitals. And you get a good benchmark idea of where you lay.
Thank you. While you were talking, I downloaded the CDC guidelines document that you mentioned early on, and I posted that to the members areas for this teleclass. So the same place where everyone downloaded the slides and handouts, there's a PDF file now posted there. If you don't already have that document, it is there for you.
Okay. Let's just take the first one then. Well, in the first scenario, you have a patient who has a CAT scan. It's showing the opacity is reported by the radiologist. And he's coming into you with that reading already before this patient is now intubated. Remember, he's admitted to the medical ICU where he's intubated at that time. You're not receiving this patient as being prior intubated. And they use wording here that is now progressive. You see here on day one now patchy consolidations, and then on day three they use the terminology of opacities of both lungs. And then on day four, you have a CAT scan. Then it shows, again, the terminology of the ground glass opacities, and you have new consolidation, et cetera. The question about these, and this is why sometimes it's gray areas, initially this case is probably not going to be a VAP. Why? Because this patient came in with the terminology according to the definition. Now, you have to then consider then on the last scenario, which is on day four here, is this then a new consolidation involving a bilaterally upper lobes? And did the CAT scan in the original reading on 0 day minus two, is that different from the CAT scan on day four? If this is considered to be not different, then this patient does not have a VAP. Anybody with the second case scenario?
Hi, I just have a question. If you have, say, two or three or four serial chest x-rays and there's no improvement but there's no change, that would still be considered a VAP, correct? Because it's not.
But it depends on
improving.
What day you're talking about. In other words, if are those chest x-rays you're mentioning from what day? Is it starting with day zero or is it starting with day five, let's say?
Well, I would say it maybe in the first case scenario.
Oh,
his
okay.
It doesn't look like it's improving.
Right, correct. In other words, if there is no improvement, there's really no change, and the patient originally had those findings with the terminology that you see in the definition, then this person doesn't have new pneumonia. This person has just continuation of pneumonia. But if you're going to have, let's take a look at the second scenario, you might as well answer it. If you see in the second scenario, to clarify, this is more the opposite kind of case. From day zero, this person has no consolidated effusion or congestion. So there is nothing here, and even on day 15, this person has lungs clear, et cetera, et cetera. Now, into day 23, now you begin to see what? Bilateral infiltrates both lungs. And remember, very important, that we're not just looking at the chest x-rays because we have to meet the definition with the other two sets of criteria. It's either looking at what the WBCs are and also looking at whether the person has fever and also whether this person had a change in blood pressure. And you'll notice very, very evidently here that the person has low blood pressure, WBCs have been falling, patient has fever and is developing now at least two serial x-rays with infiltrates, so therefore this person on a second scenario has VAP. And what about the last one?
I agree.
What about the last one?
I would say because his first one was clear, and then it just got progressively worse. WCBs were counting, or BC, excuse me, and his temp was rising. And BP fell.
Okay.
And then he died.
There is one other piece of very critical information, and it goes right up here to describing the patient itself. This patient was
intubated
4 days
prior to another facility.
So what applies now is that 48-hour rule. Okay? So if you count from day zero, now you're looking at really day two, which is 48 hours. This person already has positive chest x-rays from day one. So therefore, this case drops out. It's not a VAP.
Where are the positive chest X-rays?
On day one, it says here right upper lobe density, right upper lobe and right middle lobe consolidation, left upper lobe patchy densities.
Could this not be another facility associated ventilator associated pneumonia before this patient came into
that
your
is,
facility?
That is a perfect statement. Yes, absolutely. This may be a VAP, but not to your facility. It could be to the original facility.
Yeah.
Yep. Very good point.
So then, how would you would you report that then as a another facility
no.
Acquired?
No. We would not do that.
Okay.
we would
you notify the other facility?
Yeah, we would notify the other facility, and it would be their responsibility if they're in this reporting system to do that.
I would like to thank all of you very much, and Bob, thank you. That was a lot of work.
Thank you very much. I wanted again to thank one person here who is the director of the Healthcare Epidemiology Department, Francina Singh, who's incredibly supportive, and who is truly, really one of the experts on this entire thing. I'll get her one of these days to give one of these lectures. All right.
You'd be very welcome. Well, thank you again, and to all, thank you, and we'll talk again very soon. Goodbye.
Thank you again.